We're doing the book of Shmuel. We're up to what's called the 11th chapter. And we had seen last time that when Saul was anointed king, so people spoke badly about him and he was silent. Now, just for perspective, King Saul is already an old man. You know, he's looking for his father's donkeys, but he's going to be king a total of about 2 years. Right? This whole story, everything we hear about him is about 2 years. So he's already... What? We're in the 11th chapter of Shmuel. So King Saul was king 2 or 3 years total. And he's going to have a son who's 40 years old. So King Saul has to be in his 50s already. Right? Shmuel Aleph Yud Aleph. Shmuel, what they call the 11th chapter. So although we see he's searching for his father's donkeys, nonetheless, He's an old man. He has children already. He has children that are themselves capable of being grandparents. So we just have to get perspective. The story seems to describe it as a long period that Shaul was king. In fact, from the verses it seems, and our tradition seems to say, that it was a very short period. One verse says, Ben Shana Shaul b'molcho, King Saul was a king for a year. Shtaim. And he was king for 2 years total. So they want to say, okay, a year into his reign plus another two. So you end up with 3 years. Big deal. I'm saying, you know, it's a very short range. And he has a son who's 40 years old. So he had to be older, right? So although he seems very young in the story, you know, seems like a young man. And you see he's looking for his father's donkeys. He ain't so young. He already has daughters of marriageable age. And the whole story we're going to see now is taking place in a very short period of time. Yes?
Was he young whenever he rescued the ark or whatever?
No. Because that happened the day that Nov was destroyed. And... Shmuel passed away when he was 52. Now, that story happened when Shmuel was about 42. Shmuel passed away 6 months or something before Saul passed away. So, that means that Saul was already in his 40s when he snatched it from Og. Okay? He was in his late 30s, early 40s. Going back to... Again, I agree with you. I think most people, even people who learn this in day school and in high school, they walk around with this conception that King Saul was king for many years and this whole story took place during many years. But no. Okay, so when King Saul is shamed and people say, who's he to save us? He is silent, and that's a mistake. Our sages say, Talmid Chacham has a responsibility that when he's shamed, he should take revenge like a snake. The Torah says, Dotikom velotitor, right? But that doesn't mean that a Talmid Chacham should let his honor be trampled on. There's a certain balance. You don't have to take revenge. On the other hand, you're not supposed to let people trample on your honor, especially when he's the king of Israel and he's the leader. And so, because King Saul was silent, right away he's attacked by the king called the snake. From here we learn this concept. Vayal Nachash Amoni. Nachash, the king of the Ammonites, comes and attacks the people of Yavesh Gilad. Now this, in and of itself, needs depth. What's going on here? Yavesh Gilad was destroyed. Remember, the people of Yavesh Gilad did not join the civil war against the tribe of Benjamin. And so after the other tribes wiped out Benjamin, they went after Yavesh Gilad. They said, you guys obviously sided with them. You didn't join the war. And then they went and wiped out the city of Yavesh Gilad. So who's left? Seems like it was re-inhabited. So the people of Yavesh Gilad... No, by Jews. The people of Yavesh Gilad, whoever they are, they tell Nachash, they say, let's make a pact. We're willing to pay you taxes. We're willing to be under your rule. And he says, fine. If each of you takes out your right eye, we can make a pact. I want to shame Israel. So the elders say, give us a week. So they send word throughout Israel. And when everyone hears what's going on, everyone starts crying. No one feels they could stand up to the Ammonite king. And Shaul is coming back with his cattle, and he asks, why is everyone weeping? And they tell him what's going on, and Shaul feels the Spirit of Hashem descend upon him, and he's very upset. Notice the order, the Spirit of Hashem, and then he's upset. Because if he would have gotten upset as a human being, as a regular individual, he wouldn't have gotten the Spirit of Hashem. When he has the Spirit of Hashem as a representative of Hashem, as his leader, as one who's avenging the people of Israel's honor or Hashem's honor, then he could be upset. It's a totally different level of anger. So that anger is kosher. If it's a personal anger, then he wouldn't have attained prophecy after that. So the Spirit of Hashem settles on him and he angers. And he slices up cattle and sends it out throughout Israel and says, whoever doesn't follow me and Shmuel to war, this is what we're doing to all of his cattle. So everyone gets scared, they unite, and they count the soldiers. Each one takes a shard of earthenware and they count them, and they end up with 300,000 soldiers, another 30,000 from the tribe of Judea, and they send word to the people of Yavesh Gilad, tomorrow by midday, things are going to work out. So the people of Yavesh Gilad rejoice, and the next morning Shaul divides his camp into three troops, three battalions, and they attack Ammon, and they are victorious. By midday, they have scattered the whole Ammonite army. You can't see two standing together. Oh, the whole army has been scattered. And when the people see how quickly they were victorious under King Saul, so they say, who dared speak badly about King Saul? We want to kill him. So you see, the people had a change of heart. Meaning, when King Saul was berated and he was silent, there was a reason why he was silent. Because other people should have reacted. And we see this sometimes among the leaders of Israel, where they're being berated and they're silent because it's other people's job to stand up for them. And when no one else stands up, so they're silent. And it's a reflection on the people. So Shaul says, no, today we had such a victory, no one should die today. But what Shmuel says is, let's go and reinaugurate King Saul, now that everyone accepts him. One of the stages that have to happen in order for a king to have the legal status of a king is that the people have to accept him. So they go and anoint him as king. And they rejoice, they've just had a great victory. Shmuel tells Israel, listen, you guys asked me for a king, I listened to you. I've been leading you all this time. And I want to know, now that we're all here together, I want to know if anyone has a claim against me. I'm going to retire. If anyone here wants to say I did something wrong, I judged them unfairly, I took a bribe, I punished someone unfairly, come here, I want to answer. And the people all say, no, 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 you've done nothing wrong, you've never taken anything unfairly. And he says, okay, now that you have King Saul, you've accepted him, so God is witness and the king is witness that none of you have a claim on me. And he says, now I want to talk to you what I have to say to you. You guys remember how much God has done on your behalf. And God repeatedly saved you. Every time you went off the path and God sent enemies to attack, and then you repented and then God saved you. Time and again, this has been your history, the whole period of the judges. Now I'm warning you, I've given you the king you've asked for. But if you want to succeed, you have to be faithful to the Torah. And then you and your king will be successful. But if you don't, so then I want you to know, you will suffer and the graves will suffer. We have a tradition that when the people sin and they get punished, not only do they suffer, but their parents in the grave suffer. And it goes the other way too. When people in the grave suffer, meaning when people are treated unfairly in the graves, so then that's a sign of what's to come to the people outside the grave. Chazal taught us there's this relationship. What does it mean that the people in the grave suffer?
But what does it mean treated unfairly?
Huh?
That and the opposite. What does it mean that when we're treated unfairly, they're treated unfairly? What does it mean when they're treated unfairly, we're treated
okay,
unfairly?
If we get punished, so however it works, they get punished in the grave as well. They suffer too.
In Olam Haba, in the actual grave?
Nothing actually great. Cannot be like that. Just bombs.
Let's leave that on pause. We had a long class on this in the Ein Yaakov class, where the Talmud in Brachos says Kashe rima bivsar hamet kemachat bivsar hechai. The Talmud says when the vermin consume the flesh of the dead, it feels like the needles in the flesh of the living. That's what the Talmud says. So over there we went into a whole discussion. Do the deceased feel anything with their body or not? You can see it in the Ein Yaakov classes. I think if you want a real answer, you need a longer answer. The question's a good one, but the answer has to be a good one too.
What is Ein Yaakov? Is that a...
Ein Yaakov is a book that we learn here once a week with the Midrashim, the stories of the Shas. So, and when they're treated unfairly, the idea is that sometimes it's permissible to remove a grave, to move a grave from one place to another. There are halachos about when you're allowed to and when you're not. So if the graves are moved or touched or harmed, and it's done without the halacha's backing, without being correct halachically, so then many say that that's also a sign of what's waiting for us. Just like we say, when we suffer, they suffer. So too, if they suffer, we suffer. You see in Chazal that the way a person is buried has an impact on their peace, their tranquility in the world to come. There is a connection between the soul and the body down below. Why is there a difference between the first 3 days of mourning and after that? Because it takes 3 days for the face to decompose to a point where it changes. It's like a different face. It takes 3 days.
7 days, so
That's from a spiritual perspective. I'm saying here you see Chazal taught us a connection between the spiritual and the physical. Okay, going back to our story. So, Shmuel says, you now have the king, and if you listen to Hashem, so then things will be successful. But if not, as we said, you and your parents will suffer. And now I'm going to show you something amazing. We're in the middle of the summer, and I'm going to daven to Hashem, and you're going to hear thunder, and it's going to start raining. And all the crops are now in danger. All the food they have to eat for the next year is going to be endangered. And that should be an indication for you of how extreme what you've done is, to ask for a king to try and run away from having pious leaders. And Shmuel davens, and it starts thundering and raining in the middle of the summer. And the people are very scared that all their food's going to be destroyed. And they tell Shmuel, daven for us. We shouldn't die. We've sinned all along, and now we've made it even worse. And Shmuel says, don't worry. In spite of all that, God is going to take care of you. You have to stick to Him. And I won't stop davening for you either. Now, this is an important concept. Shmuel says, I will not sin before Hashem and cease to daven on your behalf. From here we derive a halachic concept. If one person knows that someone else needs his prayer, for example, you have a friend you know he needs a shidduch. You have a friend you know is going in for surgery. You have someone who you know who needs your prayer, he's in need. So then, if you do not pray on their behalf, that's called sinning. We derive that from here. Shmuel says, I know you need God's help, and I will not sin in ceasing to pray on your behalf. I will pray and not sin. Yes?
What does that mean that they need your prayer?
It means they're in need of something from heaven. Everyone needs something every day, right?
As
you need to breathe. What?
As their cry is not enough?
As in if someone needs something, so then...
You're not giving them a physical... Because when I think of giving, like, could you lend me 10 shekels? That's like a physical thing that you need right now.
But if you need to find a job, or you need to find a wife, or you need to be blessed with kids, or you need to, a person needs to regain their health. So all those things are needs that a person has, and if you're aware of someone else's need, then you should be davening from them. Our tefillot shouldn't only be about ourselves, they should be about the people we know and what they need. And the Talmud derives from here that if one does not pray for those he knows are in need, that's called a sin. I would mention another thing. Sometimes a person can't get what he's asking for. Sometimes if a person himself asks of heaven, so in heaven they say, oh yeah, well, let me remind you what you've been up to. Right? But if someone else prays on their behalf, then they can get it. And Rashi even says that if you want something, you should ask other people to pray on your behalf. If there's something that's important to you, ask other people to pray on your behalf. I could tell you stories about this, but stories are just that, they're stories. At any rate, this is the idea in Rashi and over here as well. We're out of time, we got to do a little bit.